Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 10, Chapter 36. Prince Andrew's regiment was among the reserves which, till after 1 o'clock, were stationed inactive behind Semenovsk under heavy artillery fire. Towards 2 o'clock, the regiment, having already lost more than 200 men, was moved forward into a trampled oatfield in the gap between Semenovsk and the Knoll Battery, where thousands of men perished that day, and on which an intense, concentrated fire from several hundred enemy guns was directed between 1 and 2 o'clock. Without moving from that spot or firing a single shot, the regiment here lost another third of its men. From in front, and especially from the right, in the unlifting smoke, the guns boomed, and out of the mysterious domain of smoke that overlay the whole space in front, quick hissing cannonballs and slow whistling shells flew unceasingly. At times, as if to allow them a respite, a quarter of an hour passed, during which the cannonballs and shells all flew overhead. But sometimes several men were torn from the regiment in a minute, and the slain were continually being dragged away, and the wounded carried off. With each fresh blow, less and less chance of life remained for those not yet killed. The regiment stood in columns of battalion 300 paces apart, but nevertheless the men were always in one and the same mood. All alike were taciturn and morose. Talk was rarely heard in the ranks, and it ceased altogether every time the thud of a successful shot and the cry of stretchers was heard. Most of the time, by their officer's order, the men sat on the ground. One, having taken off his shako, carefully loosened the gathers of its lining and drew them tighter again. Another, rubbing some dry clay between his palms, polished his bayonet. Another fingered the strap and pulled the buckle of his bandolier, while another smoothed and refolded his leg bands and put his boots on again. Some built little houses of the tufts in the ploughed ground, or plaited baskets from the straw in the cornfield. All seemed fully absorbed in these pursuits. When men were killed or wounded, when rows of stretchers went past, when some troops retreated, and when great masses of the enemy came into view through the smoke, no one paid any attention to these things. But when our artillery or cavalry advanced, or some of our infantry were seen to move forward, words of approval were heard on all sides. But the liveliest attention was attracted by occurrences quite apart from and unconnected with the battle. It was as if the minds of these morally exhausted men found relief in everyday, commonplace occurrences. A battery of artillery was passing in front of the regiment. The horse of an ammunition cart put its leg over a trace. "Hey, look at the trace horse. Get her leg out. She'll fall." "Ah, they don't see it," came identical shouts from the ranks all along the regiment. Another time, general attention was attracted by a small brown dog, coming heaven knows whence, which trotted in a preoccupied manner in front of the ranks with tail stiffly erect, till suddenly a shell fell close by, when it yelped, tucked its tail between its leg, and darted aside. Yells and shrieks of laughter rose from the whole regiment, but such distractions lasted only a moment, and for 8 hours the men had been inactive, without food, in constant fear of death, and their pale and gloomy faces grew ever paler and gloomier. Prince Andrew, pale and gloomy like everyone in the regiment, paced up and down from the border of one patch to another. At the edge of a meadow beside an oat field, with head bowed and arms behind his back, there was nothing for him to do, and no order to be given. Everything went on of itself. The killed were dragged from the front, the wounded carried away, and the ranks closed up. If any soldiers ran to the rear, they returned immediately and hastily. At first, Prince Andrew, considering it his duty to rouse the courage of the men and to set them an example, walked about among the ranks, but he soon became convinced that this was unnecessary, and that there was nothing he could teach them. All the powers of his soul, as of every soldier there, were unconsciously bent on avoiding the contemplation of the horrors of their situation. He walked along the meadow, dragging his feet, rustling the grass, and gazing at the dust that covered his boots. Now he took big strides, trying to keep the footprints left on the meadow by mowers. Then he counted his steps, calculating how often he must walk from one strip to another to walk a mile. Then he stripped the flowers from the warm wormwood that grew along a boundary rut, rubbed them in his palms, and smelt their pungent, sweetly bitter scent. Nothing remained of the previous day's thoughts. He thought of nothing. He listened with weary ears to the ever-recurring sounds, distinguishing the whistle of flying projectiles from the booming of the reports, glanced at the tiresomely familiar faces of the men and of the 1st Battalion, and waited. "Here it comes. This one is coming our way," he thought, listening to the approaching whistle in the hidden region of smoke. "One, another, again, it has hit." He stopped and looked at the ranks. "No, it has gone over. But this one has hit." And again he started trying to reach the boundary strip in 16 paces. A whiz and a thud. 5 paces from him a cannonball tore up the dry earth and disappeared. A chill ran down his back. Again he glanced at the ranks. Probably many had been hit. A large crowd had gathered near the 2nd Battalion. "Adjutant," he shouted, "order them not to crowd together." The adjutant, having obeyed this instruction, approached Prince Andrew. From the other side of the battalion, the commander rode up. "Look out!" came a frightened cry from a soldier, and like a bird whirring in rapid flight and alighting on the ground, a shell dropped with little noise within 2 steps of Prince Andrew and close to the battalion commander's horse. The horse first, regardless of whether it was right or wrong to show fear, snorted, reared, almost throwing the major, and galloped aside. The horse's terror infected the men. "Lie down," cried the adjutant, throwing himself flat on the ground. Prince Andrew hesitated. The smoking shell spun like a top between him and prostrate adjutant near a wormwood plant between the field and the meadow. "Can this be death?" thought Prince Andrew, looking with a quiet, new, envious glance at the grass, the wormwood, and the streamlet of smoke that curled up from the rotating black ball. "I cannot. I do not wish to die. I love life. I love this grass, this earth, this air." He thought this, and at the same time remembered that people were looking at him. "It's shameful, sir," he said to the adjutant. "What..." He did not finish speaking. At one and the same moment came the sound of an explosion, a whistle of splinters as from a breaking window frame, and suffocating smell of powder, and Prince Andrew started to one side, raising his arm, and fell on his chest. Several officers ran up to him. From the right side of his abdomen, blood was welling out, making a large stain on the grass. The militiamen with stretchers, who were called up, stood behind the officers. Prince Andrew lay on his chest with his face in the grass, breathing heavily and noisily. "What are you waiting for? Come along." The peasants went up and took him by his shoulders and legs, but he moaned piteously, and exchanging looks, they set him down again. "Pick him up, lift him, it's all the same," cried someone. They again took him by the shoulders and laid him on the stretcher. "Ah, God, my God, what is it? My stomach. That means death, my God," voices among the officers were heard saying. "It flew a hair's breadth past my ear," said the adjutant. The peasants, adjusting the stretcher to their shoulders, started hurriedly along the path they had trodden down to the dressing station. "Keep in step. Ah, those peasants," shouted an officer, seizing by their shoulders and checking the peasants who were walking unevenly and jolting the stretcher. "Get into step, Fedder. I say, Fedder," said the foremost peasant. "Now that's right," said one behind joyfully, when he had got into step. "Your Excellency, eh, Prince," said the trembling voice of Timokhin, who had run up and was looking down on the stretcher. Prince Andrew opened his eyes and looked up at the speaker from the stretcher, into which he His head had sunk deep, and again his eyelids drooped. The militiamen carried Prince Andrew to the dressing station by the wood where wagons were stationed. The dressing station consisted of three tents with flaps turned back, pitched at the edge of the birch wood. In the wood, wagons and horses were standing. The horses were eating oats from their movable troughs, and sparrows fled down and pecked the grain that fell. Some crows, scenting blood, flew among the birch trees, cawing impatiently. Around the tents, over more than 5 acres, blood-stained men in various garbs stood, sat, or lay. Around the wounded stood crowds of soldier stretcher-bearers with dismal and attentive faces, whom the officers, keeping order, tried in vain to drive from the spot. Disregarding the officers' orders, the soldiers stood leaning against their stretchers and gazing intently, as if trying to comprehend the difficult problem of what was taking place before them. From the tents came now loud angry voices and now plaintive groans. Occasionally, dressers ran out to fetch water, or to point out those who were to be brought in next. The wounded men, awaiting their turn outside the tents, groaned, sighed, wept, screamed, swore, and asked for vodka. Some were delirious. Prince Andrew's bearers stepping over the wounded, who had not yet been bandaged, took him, as a regimental commander, close up to one of the tents and there stopped, awaiting instructions. Prince Andrew opened his eyes and for a long time could not make out what was going on around him. He remembered the meadow, the wormwood, the field, the whirring black ball, and his sudden rush of passionate love for life. 2 steps from him, leaning against a branch and talking loudly and attracting general attention, stood a tall, handsome, black-haired, non-commissioned officer with a bandaged head. He had been wounded in the head and leg by bullets. Around him, eagerly listening to his talk, a crowd of wounded and stretcher-bearers was gathered. We kicked him out from there so that he chucked everything. We grabbed the king himself, cried he, looking around him with eyes that glittered with fever. If only reserves had come up just then, lads, there wouldn't have been nothing left of him, I tell you surely. Like all the others near the speaker, Prince Andrew looked at him with shining eyes and experienced a sense of comfort. But isn't it all the same now, thought he, and what will be there, and what has been here? Why was I so reluctant to part with life? There was something in this life I did not and do not understand. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and Andre is in big trouble. He's received a few bullets or something. Shrapnel? Was it shrapnel? And things aren't looking good. The last place you want to be is in the hospital on a battlefield. Very last place you want to be. We saw about 100 chapters back how bad it is to be in the hospital during the war. Not the best place to be. Turtle Vader says, "Do you think Andre is a goner this time? How will another brush with death affect him if he survives again?" Well, we already saw the beginnings of his epiphany as he was waiting for that thingy to explode. He suddenly became very attached to life. He's been a bit blasé about his old attachment to life recently. He doesn't seem too fussed about whether he lives or dies, I would say. But in that very last split second, he very much wanted to stay alive. We also had quite a lot of nature talk, which, you know, bodes well for an epiphany. Well, we were talking previously about the high morale on the battlefield. People were cheery, and they didn't seem to mind that their comrades were dropping like flies. But that definitely changed, especially this chapter. Suddenly it was the worst place to be. No one seemed happy. It was just grim, morose. Everyone was exhausted and horrified by what they were seeing. There was quite a sharp shift in tone. Prince Andre wasn't having a good time to begin with. His regiment wasn't coping too well. He was doing the best he could, and then kaboom. So, will he be a goner this time is the question. Well, given his sudden, profound attachment to life, it would be quite the tragedy if he was to die now. But who knows? We'll have to read on to find out. Before I sign off today, I'm going to remind everybody to extend the offer to the discount on my novels. They're not, you know, I'm no Tolstoy, but they've been described as fun to read and nice. So that's a pretty resounding endorsement. AndrewLewis.com. If you use the voucher code Warrior or Peacekeeper, one or the other, at checkout, you will receive a 15% discount on your purchase. That's pretty cool. An offer from me to you. So, go check that out if you're interested. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.